You know, I found it fascinating that as we learn through Hilchos Nida, and of course we don't get into all the intricate details of every Shaila, but as we learn through Hilchos Nida and gain a little bit of an appreciation for how complicated some of these situations can be. So as I mentioned, last week I was in Eretz Yisrael and we had the opportunity to meet many great poskim and many great rabbanim and have many rich discussions in halacha. One of the highlights of our trip, as always, every year when we take this trip, we always visit Machon Pua. And I always find it to be an eye-opening experience. We can talk here in theory about what are we supposed to do if these situations come up or if those come up. There you have in Machon Pua, which is an organization that is really dedicated to helping people who have questions in Taras HaMishpacha and sometimes very, very complicated questions in Hilchos Nida. So they deal with them head-on. So they brought in one of the Dayanim. As we were there, one of the Dayanim was walking by. So Rabbi Weitzman called him in. Rabbi Weitzman is the head of Machon Pua. And he called him in and he said, so can you share with us, what are you working on? Just, you know, what are you working on today? He says, oh, what am I working on today? You have no idea what I'm working on. So he tells us a fascinating story, a very tragic story, but an interesting one. So he said that there was a woman who got married, he said, I think at 34 or 35 years old. And she had been able to conceive their first child naturally, which was a wonderful simcha. The baby was born, everything's healthy. And now at this point, she's 37, 38. And they were trying to conceive another child. She was nervous if she gets too old, she's not going to want to have children at that stage. So she's really trying to have another child before she gets to that point. So they were trying to conceive. Nothing was working naturally. So they decided the woman had frozen her eggs because as she was getting older, she was a little bit nervous that maybe she wasn't going to be able to get married in time. So she had frozen eggs from before she had gotten married. So they decided to do an IVF cycle and they were going to do a pregnancy that way. So that was the plan. They generally, especially when you have an older woman who is not so old, but when you have a woman who's close to 40 or something like that, correct me if I'm wrong, you do IVF? Yeah. But you know a fair amount about it, I'm sure. So when you have somebody of that age, we're concerned that maybe the body is not going to take to the first implantation that you do. So often they'll put in more than one egg just to make sure that one of them is going to take. Anyway, that's what they did. They ended up putting in two. One of them did not take. However, the one that did take split and became identical twins. Okay. Now, that was very exciting. If that's where it would have ended, it would be great. However, because of the fact that in advance for this IVF treatment, they gave her all kinds of hormones and her body was on all kinds of treatments. So the body then had a lot going on and she naturally conceived at the same time. How improbable is that? She naturally conceived at the same time a child as well after trying for months and months and it wasn't working. And that child also split and became identical twins. So now she has four, she has four fetuses all at the same time. What? What do you say? Like Mitzrayim. Can you explain to us how does that work exactly? Does this make sense?
Yeah. Any pregnancy.
Any pregnancy can split. But what's the, is it true that it's a higher likelihood that that's going to happen because of the hormones they put in at the time of the IVF treatment? Or it's just a fluke that this happened? Just a fluke. So they can try to become pregnant naturally for months and months. It didn't work. All of a sudden, they did the IVF. What? And you. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, naturally, it does work. So this is very unusual, where the IVF was put in, the IVF worked, and at the same time, she also became naturally pregnant, and it split twice. So now they had a Shiloh. In general, I would imagine that for a woman to carry and deliver four healthy children is a very low likelihood that all of them are going to be healthy and survive and have a viable life ahead of them. So to go ahead with the pregnancy of four of them is probably not a good idea. Now, how do you decide which one to eliminate? So you have to test all of them and see. Maybe there's a natural reason to take one of them out of the equation because one of them is deformed or one of them is sick. They looked at all of them. None of them have any problems. So now what do you do? Now none of them have any problems because they're in a very, it's strange to say infant stage, but they are in a very beginning stage and you can't really detect all the problems that may come up later on in the pregnancy. So this was a very serious shaila. So now that we're going to take out one, how many more do you say that we should take out? How many more would you say that they should take out? So you look at the numbers. What do the statistics say for a woman who's having triplets? What's the likelihood that all three of those kids are going to carry to term and are going to be healthy? Of course, we've all seen triplets in our lives, but what's the likelihood? What do the numbers show? And what is the difference between triplets and twins? How different are the numbers? They told us, at least in Israel, they said the numbers are much lower risk when you have twins than when you're carrying triplets. I don't know what those numbers are. What are they? Both. Carrying full-term triplets versus carrying full-term twins.
Full-term triplets is almost never seen. We're all born at 32, 31, 33 weeks.
Okay, and full-term twins?
Twins who get to 36, 37 weeks, much safer.
Uh-huh. So that was the question. Now, so let's say we decide we're going to...
37 years old, 24.
Right. Plus she's 37. So let's say we say we're going to take out two, now we're going to have twins. She says, I didn't want to have twins. I wasn't expecting this. So do we care what she says? Does it matter? So you don't want to have twins, so therefore we should just get rid of them? Is that really a reasonable request? So this was the shaila that they happened to be dealing with the day we were in Machon Pua, and I'm listening to this. I'm just saying, you know, here we are talking in theory, maybe this, maybe that, oh, you know, Hilchas Nidan, what do you do? And somebody calls up with a very serious shaila like this. Just somebody called on the hotline one day to discuss this question. And it was just another day in the office in Machon Pua. So, yes, that's correct. So anyway, I just thought that and everything else we spoke to them about was fascinating. I don't know if you've ever seen the Svarim of Machon Pua. Anyone has ever seen them? They actually have Svarim that are amazing. They put together a lot of the cases that they work on. And the Mahalach of Machon Pua is very different than many other organizations that we have in America. Again, all the organizations do different things. There's Eitim and there's Bonei Olam and all kinds of relief organizations and different programs, different things. But generally what I found is, let's say, I've dealt with Eitim and Bonei Olam in many different cases in our community, and all of them are doing wonderful, amazing work. They all actually do different kinds of work. Bonei Olam generally funds procedures and tries to help people be able to get to those opportunities that they otherwise would not be able to pay for on their own. And Eitim is generally more of a support system. They don't generally give money toward procedures anyway, but it doesn't really matter what each of the things do. But what I have found is that Eitim and Bonei Olam each have their own rules and regulations based on the poskim that they turn to of what they're willing to be involved with and what perhaps not. You know, like for example, I know that Bonei Olam is very much not a fan of surrogacy and halacha. They don't think that it's a halachic option. They're not comfortable with it, and it's a big machlokas poskim, and their poskim feel that this is not an appropriate option for a couple, even though they've tried everything else and they have no other option other than that, or adoption. They feel that this is something that should not be considered an option at all. Okay, so there, I respect the fact that they feel that way, but it troubles me that when we have a couple who needs to get to that point, and you know, they won't collaborate, but that's the psak they follow, that's what they do. Eitim also has their own psakim, their own people that they ask, and that's the way they do it. Machon Pua is not like that. Machon Pua feels that they are a referral service. They deal with the shaila and they ask you, are you from this kind of community? Are you a Sephardi? Are you an Ashkenazi? And they deal with every shaila. They ask all the Gedolei HaPoskim from across the spectrum to try to understand what is the consensus opinion. And maybe you're from this community, they can give you a tailor-made psak based on the person who you would generally ask your shailas to. And that's what I find very refreshing. When they write in their svarim the answer to a particular problem. Again, this is not to call out any of the other organizations. They each do their own thing, and I understand why you would want to have your own posek who's setting the policy for the organization. What's beautiful about Machon Pua is they actually talk to all the rabbanim across the spectrum and try to get an opinion from everyone and try to get a perspective from everybody about all the issues they're dealing with, which gives you sometimes a much richer experience. So when they write it up in the Svarim, they actually quote the tshuvas that everybody sent in about all the questions they had referred them with. And, you know, it's just interesting. Machon Pua puts out these svarim once a year or something like that, and always amazing to see how many new shailas there are and how much this field of medicine is developing and how there's always more to talk about. It's just something that always, always, always amazes me. We had a big discussion there about genetic testing and how far we're supposed to go and how accurate or inaccurate they are, and they're showing us the numbers. It's really just fascinating, amazing work that they do. And beautiful to see that all the halachas that we're learning are actually being put into practice in a very practical way. So what we're going to talk about this evening, and again, we're going to probably have to continue next week in Mirz Hashem on Monday evening, is when we have this idea of a veses. What does it mean that a woman has a veses? There's something called a veses kavua, and there's something else that's called a veses she'eno kavua. What that means is there are some women who have a very predictable cycle. Every month, the same day of the month, at the same time, or every month as they do a certain activity or engage in a certain behavior, this is what's going to happen. And we know from the outset that this is what's going to happen. That is very uncommon. It's very unusual to have a veses kavua, where it's exactly the same time, every single month, at the same day, at the same exact moment. That's something that's usually not the case. And usually what we deal with is something that is called a veses she'eno kavua. But given that, we know that, as we spoke in the previous weeks, for somebody to be intimate with his spouse, with his wife, at a time when she is considered to be a nida, is an issa d'oraisa, it's an issa karis, and it's something that we have to take very seriously. As a result of that, we have this idea that you should try to put a safeguard in the way to make sure that you don't come to that, to make sure that you don't have any problem along the way. So what kind of safeguard can you have? And this is what we call the sugya of vestos. Vestos means different times of the month when we have to imagine that maybe there's a higher likelihood, a higher probability that the woman is going to have a flow, that she's going to have a cycle at this time of the month. And we are machmir upon ourselves that we should already abstain from being together because there's a very high likelihood or possibility that maybe this is going to be the time of the month when the woman is going to be anida. This comes from the Gemara Maseches Shavuos Daf Yud Ches. It learns it from the pasuk v'hizhartem es bnei Yisrael mitumasa. Now the simple reading of the pasuk is v'hizhartem es bnei Yisrael mitumasa means you have to give shiurim, you have to teach the halacha that they should all know. Make sure that when you're tameh, you shouldn't do this, and this is how you become tameh. This is how you become tar. These are the kinds of activities you're allowed to be involved with when you're tameh. These are the kinds of things you have to stay away from. All of that is what the Torah means when it says v'hizhartem es bnei Yisrael mitumasa. Beyond that, the Gemara Maseches Shavuos says it also means you should warn the Jewish people that when they're coming close to a time when they're going to have the nida cycle, they should make sure to abstain to make sure that they don't come too close to tuma. Similar, not exactly the same, but similar to what the Gemara says by a nazir. You have a nazir who's restricted from all kinds of different activities. He's not allowed to go to a cemetery. He's not allowed to drink wine. He's not allowed to do a few different things because he is considered to be kodesh la'ashem. He's considered to be living a different kind of reality than everybody else. Okay. So, would you tell a Nazir he's not allowed to drink grape juice? So?
Yeah, he's not allowed to drink grape juice.
What?
Nazir can't
drink. Us, grape juice is wine, grape juice is the same, it's not?
Yes, you make a kefir on it.
Yes, so the Gemara says there, with regard to a Nazir, Amrinan l'nazira schar sachar. We tell a Nazir, stay far away, make big circles around the things that you're not allowed to do. So if we tell you you're not allowed to go to a cemetery, it doesn't just mean you should stand on the fence to the cemetery and hand things over to your friend. No, it means you should stay away from the cemetery. It's not where you belong. Because if you're going to get too close, ultimately something's going to happen. You're going to end up doing something that you shouldn't do. And this is a general rule. It's a general principle that we find not only by a nazir. It's something that we find by many different areas of halacha as well. The Mesilas Yesharim actually writes, don't think that this is limited when the Torah says, "Ushmartem es mishmarti." The Gemara says, what does it mean when the Torah says, "Ushmartem es mishmarti"? If the Torah tells me, don't talk Lashon Hara, if the Torah tells me you have to observe Shabbos and don't violate a melacha, so what does it mean? An extra prohibition, "Ushmartem es mishmarti"? The Torah already told me I should be careful to violate, not to violate any Avera and to make sure to fulfill all the mitzvahs. So what does it mean, "Ushmartem es mishmarti"? The Gemara says, "Asu mishmeres lemishmarti." That the Chachamim in every generation have an obligation to set up safeguards based on the realities of the time, to know what the fabric of the community is all about, to know what is going to cause the community to potentially make a mistake, and to put a safeguard in place to make sure they don't do it. That's Ushmartem es Mishmarti. Writes the Mesilas Yesharim, this is not something that is only limited to the Bezdin or the Chachamim of a generation. This is every individual. I have to look at my own life, and I have to think to myself, where are the pitfalls in my life where I am prone to make a mistake? And after studying that, after looking at it, I have to make safeguards for myself. So I've often had this conversation with students who graduate YU and go for the first job. And they're all nervous about what's going to be in the workplace, and they're not used to it, and they're going to encounter all these people, and they're not going to, and it's a, you know, it's an environment that they're just not comfortable in. And the answer is, you have to make asu mishmeres lemishmarti. You have to make a gather for yourself. No one's going to be able to tell you what you need to do. I don't know what your taivas are. I don't know what your predispositions are. I don't know what challenges you're going to have. You have to study the environment that you're in, and you have to act accordingly based on the reality that's in front of you and the challenges that you are faced with. And nobody else is going to be able to tell you that. That, writes the Mesilas Yesharim, is something that is not limited to the Chachmei Ador. That's something that is an individual obligation to every person based on the kinds of circumstances and experiences that you are going to be involved with. So that is what the Gemara says. When it comes to Hilchos Nida, when it comes to a woman who is expecting to have her period, we have a halacha that not only is a couple not allowed to be together when a woman is a Nida, but we have to make the circle expand it a little bit. And we have to say, even around the time when we anticipate that she's going to become a Nida, that would also be something that would be an expectation that a husband abstain from being together with his wife. So we have a Gemara Maseches Yevamah Samach Beis, where the Gemara says, Chayim Adam Lifkot Es Ishto B'Shashu Hu Yotze L'Derech. This is not, I'm going totally off script. You go to a different shiur usually? Okay, I'm sorry. You know, we're in other planets here sometimes. So the Gemara says that before a husband goes on a trip, before he leaves his wife, he has a chiyuv, he has an obligation, Lifkot Es Ishto. Now what does it mean, Lifkot Es Ishto? What does it mean? Remember. What? Remember. To remember her. So what does it mean to remember her? So it says, what? Hashem Pakad Asar. So what does it mean? I have to make my wife pregnant? What if my wife is 80 years old? Mitzvah Zona. So this is a Machlokas HaRishonim. Rashi says it means, Hashem Pakad Asar means the husband and wife should be together, and he should fulfill his mitzvah of ona. He should be together with his wife before he goes on a trip. His wife is going to miss him. She's going to be distraught over the fact that he's going away for a couple of days. So before he leaves, this is an obligation that he has to do the mitzvah of ona with his wife. Rabbeinu Tam says, no, it doesn't mean that. It means bedvarim. Go to dinner with your wife that night. Go together with your wife and talk to her. And when you go to dinner, put your phone away. That's what it means. Before you go on a trip and you're not going to be together with your wife, sit down with your wife. I always say over the bar, when I talk to Hassanim, which I don't often do, but when I do, so I don't get the wrong idea. If you have a son who's getting married, I don't give Chassan classes, not my thing, but I do talk to Hassanim once in a while, and I always tell them over the Vart from my grandfather. My grandfather grew up in Vizhnitz in Europe, and he says that the Malamed used to teach them Chumash all the time. And as they were in grade school and they were learning Chumash, so the Malamed taught them that every couple, every husband has a chiyuv she'er ksus ve'ona. So what does it mean, she'er ksus ve'ona? So he said, he remembers the Malamed was trying to translate for them. What does it mean? Now, what's he going to say? A bunch of five-year-old kids? So she'er ksus, he says, well, he has an obligation to give his wife food and to give her clothing and to provide for her. Ona, what's he going to say? So how's he going to explain that? So he said, in Yiddish, he said, sight, time. A husband has to give his wife time. So my grandfather said, he got a little older and he realized, hey, that's not the translation of the word. That's not what ona means. You look in the Gemara, ona means tashmish. Ona means he has to be intimate with his wife. So that's part of the obligation that a husband signs up to when he gets married, that he's going to not only provide her with her physical needs and her emotional needs, but also with her needs that she has in the intimate life as well. The husband has to make sure to provide for her. My grandfather said he had tainas on the Malamed. Why he lied to him? He didn't tell him the right answer. Then he said as he got older, he realized, no, ona really does mean the pashup shot is tzeit. What is the primary obligation of a husband toward his wife? He has to give her time. He has to give her attention. And there's nothing more important than that. I actually saw the other day, anyone saw, there was a changing of the guards with the new government. So there was the new government in Israel. So there was the IDF chief of staff, Avi Kochavi, was the chief of staff for the last, I think, 35, 40 years, something, a long time, I think it said. He was a... What? That's it?
Every 4 years.
Oh, so I misread. Okay. Thank you. Maybe I read 40 instead of 4. Okay, that's not so long. Okay, anyway, so there's a new chief of staff who was just sworn in the other day, and they had a changing of the guards, and very nice. They retired the old, they put in the new, and Avi Kochavi gave a little drasha before he stepped down from the position. And I thought his drasha was very meaningful. And this is something, you know, you can have tainas in Eretz Yisrael, it's an anti-religious medina, and all these problems that are going on, and there's a lot of issues going on. But you know, something I find so inspiring, and you can disagree with me, but something I find so inspiring is, even the Chiloni, I don't think this person is from Avi Kochavi, I don't think he's from. Yeah. they're quoting psukim, they're saying verdach from chumash, like it's just amazing. It's amazing. I met last week, we met with a lot of great people in Eretz Yisrael, and along the way, it happened totally by mistake. We are not a political group of Rabbanim at all. We are 10 Rabbanim who really want to learn. Turns out, Bezalel Smotrich had contacted me that he wanted to meet. And I told him, I'm coming to Eretz Yisrael with a group of 10 Rabbanim. Why don't we meet then? Fine. So we met together. And I said, we're Rabbanim. We're not coming to the Knesset. Like, this is not what we do. You want to meet us, you'll come meet us, whatever. So he did. Which is like, I think about it in retrospect, not so respectful. You know, he is like a pretty powerful guy in the government, but like, I don't do these things. Anyway, he came to meet with us. Then the next thing I knew, I got a call the next day from the Aliyah minister who says, oh, I heard you met with Bezalel Smotrich. He's a minister. Why don't you meet with me? I said, we're not a political group. This is not what we do. He says, no, I'd like to talk to you. So he came. Then the next thing we knew, one of the representatives of the Aguda party contacted us that he wanted to meet. And then Eli Cohen, who's the foreign minister, who's the second to the prime minister, who said, you know, I have a problem because the Americans are sending a delegation next week of all the diplomats, and I really haven't met with any American delegations yet. So can you guys do me a favor? Can you come and we'll have a conversation or whatever? Anyway, so we ended up meeting with a lot. And I was very inspired when we came to Eli Cohen. He's the foreign minister. He's not from at all. He's the nicest person, but he's a Chiloni Lagamri. And he's sitting there giving us his speech about why he took the job and why he feels so passionate about it. And he's quoting Psukim in Tanakh, left and right. It was amazing. Just amazing to me. This is like, if you don't see Geula in all of this, now maybe you'll say, oh, it's part of the Satan, that the Satan is gay. I don't know, you can twist it. To me, I was so inspired. I like to see positive things. I was so inspired. You know, we sat there, you can read in the newspaper, Bezalel Smotrich is this, and the politicians are that, and it's so terrible. I can tell you, Bezalel Smotrich wouldn't sit down at the table till every one of the Rabbanim was seating. He said, Kavod HaRabbanim, I don't sit down until all the Rabbanim are comfortable. Then he was about to say Avod, he told us something from the Netziv. He had a lot of great Divrei Torah outside of the presentation that he made. He, you know, he stops himself in the middle. He says, you know, it's really not respectful that I'm saying a Divrei Torah in front of the Rabbanim. Can I ask Rishus from all the Rabbanim here? Like, again, just a person who's in a tremendous position of power and influence who has the sensitivity to think about the fact that he's in the presence of people who are greater Talmid HaChamim than him and represent something much larger than he does. I don't know. To me, it was very inspiring. Why am I saying that? Oh, so Avi Kochavi gave a drasha. So what did he say? Avi Kochavi gave a drasha that I found very inspiring. He said that he used to tell his soldiers the following all the time. What is the way to be a successful chief of staff of the IDF? Now, I don't know why he's giving over this message, because how many people listening are actually going to apply for the job of being the chief of staff of the IDF? Okay. But what he said was as follows. He said, let's look at the first disaster in history with human beings. What was the first disaster in history? When did something go very wrong? Cain and Hevel. Why did Cain kill his brother Hevel?
Jealousy.
Oh, so I would have said, I think this is an interesting chop he had. I would have said it's because he was jealous. He was jealous of his brother Hevel. He tied it, it's not the pshat. He said, you look carefully in the psukim, it's not what it says. It says that Cain hated his brother, and he was looking at him, and he was very upset. That's not when he killed him. When does he kill him? When HaKadosh Baruch Hu accepts Hevel's karbon. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu accepts, and when the Ribono Shel Olam shows him, I'm not paying attention to you. I'm paying attention to him, and I'm ignoring you. You're not worth it to me, and he is. That's what caused the first disaster in human history. And he said, I learned from that story in Chumash, that if you don't give people the attention that they think they need, it can lead to the worst calamity in the world. And he said that's why every time he visited an army base, after he finished, he went over to all the soldiers and all the mifakdim, and he told them something positive about themselves, and he made sure they were noticed. To me, that was such a powerful takeaway, such an important message. And again, you have the chief of staff of the IDF who's thinking about a million other things, who has a million other things to give a drasha about as he's stepping down, but that's what he's focusing on. To me, I don't know, I was very taken by that. And I thought it was very inspiring. And when it comes to this Gemara, the Gemara says, Chayim Adam Lifkod Esishto Kodem Shiyotze Lederech. The Gemara doesn't say, make sure your suitcase is packed. The Gemara doesn't say, double check your ticket to make sure you have everything properly. It doesn't say, make sure to leave money behind so that, you know, you can pay the cleaning lady. The Gemara says the first thing you need to make sure is that your wife is taken care of. And like Rabbeinu Tam says, it doesn't mean that a husband and wife have to be intimate before he leaves. It means that a husband and wife have to make sure that they have dvarim, that they talk to each other before. Because that's what she's going to miss. Because that's the relationship that she expects to have. Anyway, so that's what the Gemara says. So the Ritva says, I don't understand. What does it mean? Chayvanim lifko desishto kodem shiyotze lederech? Of course, who wouldn't do that? Which husband wouldn't talk to his wife before he leaves? So the Gemara says, afilu be, even at the time of the month, I'm forgetting the line in the Gemara, even at the time in the month when he's supposed to be porish meyishto, says the Gemara, if she's supposed to become a nida tomorrow, and I'm going on a trip tomorrow, and we already are supposed to abstain tonight because it's the ona hasamach leveses, because it's the time right before she's expected to become a nida. So I would have said that a husband should abstain from being together with his wife because we have this prohibition of getting too close for his hartemes b'nei Yisrael mitumasam. Nonetheless, the Gemara says that he should be with his wife. Why should he be with his wife? Because he's about to go on a trip. But what do you mean? We have a general principle that he has to stay away from his wife at the time that she's about to become a nida. So that's the kasha of the Ritva. How can it be? Says the Ritva, it must be that this is not an Isra de Araisa. It's not that the Torah says that right before she becomes a nida, he has to abstain. It's an Isra de Rabbanan. It's an Asmachta. It's something that is it's a geder, the same way we say by a Nazir. Stay away from the cemetery. Stay away from wine. Don't have anything to do with all of these issues because you're going to end up making a mistake, and that mistake is going to be very consequential. So too, over here the Gemara says, generally we assume that a husband has to be Porish Meishto a little bit before she becomes a Nida to make sure he's not going to make a mistake. Aye, but if he's going on a business trip and he's not going to be home and his wife is going to miss him so much before he goes away, so then we assume, even if that night before he leaves is that time when he's supposed to be Porish Meishto, still the Gemara says he's supposed to override that Isser Derabanan, and he should rather choose to go ahead and be together with his wife. But again, I think this machlokas from Tam and Rashi is so critical to understand what is the obligation of a husband toward his wife. Rashi says he has an obligation to fulfill her needs and her desires and to fulfill her needs in an intimate way. And Rabbeinu Tam says, no, what are you getting fancy on me? The most important need of a woman is that her husband should recognize her. The most important need of a woman is there should be dvarim, they should talk to each other, and he should give her attention. And I can't tell you how many times I've gone places and you see a husband and wife sitting together and they're not talking to each other and each one's on their phone and they're not even paying attention. Now, I'm just as guilty. People see me walking with my wife every so often. We try to take a walk a lot. And sometimes I'll be on the phone. And what bothers me more than anything else is when other people take their phones out and take pictures of us. That's like really crazy. And I'm always wondering, what are you taking a picture of? Like, why is this such a big deal that I'm taking a walk with my wife? It's interesting to you? Okay. So one of these pictures that has circled back to me was a picture of me on my phone, on my wife on her phone. So I said, you know, at least I walk with my wife every day. We take a walk every day. Sometimes it has to be a business call. You know, sometimes I need to pick up the phone because there's things going on in the shul. I need to do things. But nonetheless, what the Rishonim are teaching us is it's important that we give attention. And I think to prove it from that story of Cain and Hevel is actually a very fascinating point, one that I actually never really considered. I always looked at it at face value. Cain and Hevel hated each other because there was jealousy between them, and that's what led to the calamity. And he's giving another insight, which I thought is very, very interesting. Anyway, I see that we're not going to have enough time to get into the whole discussion of Vestos tonight, because it's already almost 9:30, but at least we will begin. And again, Monday evening, we will continue Amirza Hashem. So just to better understand what the whole story of Vestos is all about, we generally assume that a woman has a cycle about once a month, give or take a couple of days, but it's generally about once a month. Now, the couple is expected to abstain from being intimate with each other when we're talking about a situation that this time of the month is probable that she's going to be getting her period. And that's why we have to figure out, when is it most probable that she's going to be getting her period? So the first thing that the Gemara describes is something that's referred to as Yom HaChodesh. You have to mark down on the calendar which day of the month did she get her period in the last month. So let's say it was Gimel Nisan. And then next month, you have to assume that on Gimel Iyar is going to be the same time that she's going to get the period. Now, even though some months are Chodesh Malay, some months are Chodesh Chaser. So when you think about it, it's very strange. Why should there be any relevance to Gimel Iyar when it's not always going to be the same amount of days? So it's a strange calculation the Gemara makes, but the Gemara does say that one of the things that we need to be concerned about is the fact that the Yom LaChodesh, that the day on the month when she did have her last period, there is a high likelihood, there is a high chance, even if it was only a 28-day month or maybe a 29-day month is going to be the next one, still, the Gemara says the Yom LaChodesh is something that we have to be concerned about. And on that day of the month, they have to abstain because we have to anticipate that maybe she's going to become a Nida. Let's turn to the first entry in this discussion about Vestos, which is on page 27. So the Gemara here, Meseches Nida, Daf Tes Zayin Amud Aleph, tells us as follows. Itmar, Isha Sheyeshla Veses, Vihigia Shas Vesta, Velo Budka, Velo Besov Budka, Amara Budka Matza Tmeya Tmeya, Tahora Tahora, Shmuel Amar Afilu Budka Matza Tahora, Nami Tmeya Mimnesha Reach Vizmanoba. So the Gemara here is talking about, I know I just read that very quickly, it's a Machlokas Rav and Shmuel, but what the Gemara is introducing us to here is we have an assumption that there's going to be like clockwork. A woman's body is going to work in the same way every month, the same cycle every month. And when you come to that time in the month when you assume that she's going to have her period, when she's going to have her cycle, we have a right to say, yes, that she is considered to be Tameya. She is considered to be Tameya. Look at this. Rav says, I'm a Rav. Badko matzas Tameya, Tameya. If a woman does a bedika on that day, let's say Gimel Iyar is 30 days later, the next month, 29 days later, whatever it's going to be, Badko Matza Tameya Tameya. If she does a bedika and it turns out that it's not clean, okay, so then she's Tameya. Tahora says Rav, if it turns out that she's Tahora and there's nothing dirty on the bedika, then she's Tahora. Shmuel Amar Shmuel says no, Afilu Badko Matza Tahora. Even if she does a bedika on Yom Gimel Iyar, and it turns out that there's nothing wrong with the bedika, still, Nami Tameya. Shmuel says we have to assume that she's Tameya. What do you mean she's Tameya? Why do you have any grounds to say she's Tameya? She did a bedika and everything's fine. Mipnei she'oreach b'zman oba. What does it mean, oreach b'zman oba? The guest comes when they're supposed to come. What does it mean? It means you have an expectation that a woman's cycle is going to begin on this day of the month. And we assume that it happened. How'd she get a clean bedika? Okay, she bled in the morning. She didn't notice. She was busy with other things, which is also very improbable, but okay. The Gemara says that that's the assumption that we make. And oreach b'zman oba, we assume that the cycle began when we expected it. And you must have missed it. She did a bedika now and she's tahora. Shmuel says no. Now, we don't paskin like Shmuel, but the point is, from Shmuel's words, you see that we take this very seriously. We have an assumption that every month is going to be a time when we have every right to assume that she's going to become a Nida at this time of the month. So that is what the Gemara teaches us.
Does he mean Tameya Mamish or just us of Abal?
I mean, the Gemara here is talking about Tameya with respect to her husband, but what's the difference?
No, because I'm saying if she becomes a real Nida, then she's Tameya. She can't eat the truma or whatever.
So that's a good point. So look at the next piece of the Gemara. Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak Amar. What exactly is the machlokes Rav and Shmuel here? That's what they ask. So the machlokes is bevestos gufayu kamafligi. They're arguing in the nature of this idea of a veses. Mar savar vestos de araisa, umar savar vestos de rabbanon. When we say that there's an assumption that a woman is going to have her cycle on X day of the month at this time, does that mean that the Torah says you have to abstain then? Or is that something that the Chachamim made Gzeira Derabbanan and said, no, you have to stay far away, and because we have an assumption that this is going to happen, therefore Midirabbanan, you have to stay away. And that is the Machlokes Rav and Shmuel. Okay, now, what difference would it make if this is only Din Derabbanan or if it's actually D'Oraisa? One of the differences that the Shulchan Aruch says is, if this would only be Midirabbanan, then we would say, the only thing you need to do is abstain from actual Tashmish Hamita, from actual intimacy. But chibuk v'nishuk, for a husband to touch his wife, for a husband to start doing harchakos, to stay, to do all the different things that we separate during the time of nidus, we're not going to go that far just for a chashash midirabbanan that maybe this is the time when they're going to become tmeya. Nope. Therefore, we assume you limit it only to actual tashmish hamita, to actual intimacy, but everything surrounding that would not be a problem at the time of the vesis. That is exactly what the Gemara is describing here, and that is the machlokes Rav and Shmuel. Shmuel says Vesas Daraisa. And because there's Daraisa, we have to be Machmer, we have to assume you go to the extreme. What does it mean to go to the extreme? It means we assume this happened, and we assume maybe you missed it, and now that you did a bedika and it's clean, well, it's some fluke, it's a strange thing that she had a very short period in the morning, but we have every right to assume that everything happened the way it was supposed to and exactly at the time that it was supposed to, and therefore he says Vestos d'oraisa, we have to be machmer. Rav says, no, the whole Vestos is only midirabbanan, and therefore, if she does a bedika and it's tahora, she's tahora. this is the day when she's supposed to have the onset of her period? Okay. Yeah, that's what the Gemara is describing here. Yeah, we're going to get into the details soon. What?
She gets married to the first time, then.
Yeah. Yeah. So how do we paskin? Shulchan Aruch says, we're going to finish in a minute, Shulchan Aruch paskins that on the day of the Veses, on the day of the expected cycle and the expected flow, the Shulchan Aruch says that all they have to do is abstain from Tashmish Shamita, but Chibuk V'Nishuk would not be a problem. What do you see from the Shulchan Aruch? It seems clear that the Shulchan Aruch says that it's only the Rabbanon, and that's why you do not have a Chiyuv to abstain from all the different things at the time of the Aveses. And based on that, to your point, the Rambam says, in Hilchos Mishkav Umoshav, which is something that maybe we don't study too often, it's Hilchos Tumah V'Tahara, but I looked up the Rambam today. The Rambam in Hilchos Mishkav Umoshav, Paragimal Alachates, writes, Ein Sarfan Alau Chuma V'Kachim. If you had a woman in the time of her Veses, when she is being Porish Mibaila, who goes ahead and touches Chuma V'Kachim, oh, so now that's very consequential. Would you say that now we should burn the Chuma? Because now it's considered to be Chuma Temeya? Or would you say, what do you mean? The woman is not yet a Nida. This was just a Veses. Well, that depends. If you assume Veses de Oraisa, and we consider her to be a full-fledged Nida, like Shmuel says, even if she does a Bedika, it's a problem, then you would say, you have to be Sarfes HaChuma. You have to make every assumption that it goes to the extreme. On the other hand, the Rambam Paskins, that were Ein Sarfen Alas HaChuma. If a woman, Bishas Vesta, touched Chuma or Kachim, so says the Rambam, we wait. Tolim, we wait. What does it mean we wait? Let's wait a couple of days. Let's see what's going to happen. If in the next day or two we see that she becomes a Nida, then maybe Lemafreya, we have to assume she was a Nida then already. But if nothing happens, then we have every right to assume that the Chuma and the Kachim and everything that she touched is Tahar, and there's nothing wrong at all because she herself was Tahara, and there's no reason to have any concern at all. So this is really the introduction to the whole, what? The Rabbanon, that's why the Rambam says, if the woman Bishas Vesta touches Truma V'Kachim, we're not going to be Sarafit, we're going to be Tolit, which means we're going to wait. Let's wait a few hours, let's wait a day, let's see what happens. If nothing happens, then it reverts back to being Truma Tahara and Kachim Tahara. But if it turns out that she becomes a Nida, then we assume the Vesta's kicked in, and this is considered to be something that would now be Truma Temeya or Kachim Temeya. Okay, so